Welcome to EAN Cast, your weekly source for education, research, and updates from the European Academy of Neurology.
Hello, and welcome to EAN Cast, weekly neurology. My name is Francesco Germano. I am a neurologist and neurophysiologist working with both children and adults, and I currently practice at Galliera Hospital in Genoa, Italy. I'm also a member of the executive board of the EIN Child Neurology, where I represent the residents and the research fellows section. Today, I have the pleasure, perhaps even the challenge, of wearing two hats. I will be moderating this episode while also taking part in the discussion as one of the guests. This episode is part of the podcast series, Are Children Small Adults? A question that is simple on the surface, yet deeply complex in the daily clinical practice. Through this series, we aim to explore neurological disease across the lifespan, focusing on what truly changes with age, what remains the same, and why these distinctions matter for patient care. In today's episode, we will be focusing on Guillain-Barré syndromes and other inflammatory neuropathies across ages. These disorders are particularly well suited to this discussion. Although they share common immunological mechanisms, their clinical presentation, disease course, diagnostic challenges, and management strategies can differ markedly between pediatric and adult patients. Subtle differences in symptoms, electrophysiological findings, and recovery patterns may have a major impact on clinical decision, especially in acute and emergency settings. To explore this aspect, I'm very pleased to welcome a colleague and friend also joining us from Genoa, Dr. Matteo Cataldi, that is a child neuropsychiatrist with strong expertise in clinical neurophysiologies and neuromuscular emergencies. His work lies at the crossroads of pediatric neurology, acute neuromuscular disorders, and electrophysiology, making him an ideal partner for today's discussion. Together, we will discuss how inflammatory neuropathies present at different ages, where pediatric and adult perspectives align, and where they clearly diverge. Our goal is to offer clinically relevant insights, encourage dialogue between pediatrics and adult neurologists, and ultimately contribute to a more integrated, lifespan-oriented approach to the neurologist. Matteo, thank you very much for joining us today, and welcome to the EAN Cast.
Thank you, Francesco. It's really a pleasure to be here. And I really like the framing of this series, because in neurology, we often say that children are not just small adults, but in practice, we still tend to think in adult patterns and then try to adapt them. GBS is a perfect example of this. The immunological process may be similar across ages, but the way children present, deteriorate, and recover can be very different, and those differences matter, especially in acute settings. So, I'm very happy to take part in this discussion and to explore where pediatric and adult perspectives truly overlap, and where they clearly don't.
Amazing, Matteo. So, before we dive into mechanism and management, let's take a more concrete look at epidemiology, because sometimes it's boring, but numbers, patterns, and real-life differences across ages matter when you are actually seeing patients. If you are on call and a patient presents with an acute or subacute weakness, inflammatory neuropathies may not be the most common diagnosis, but they are common enough that missing them has real consequences. So, starting with the most frequent entity, Guillain-Barré syndrome, large population-based studies consistently report an overall incidence of about 1 to 2 cases per 100,000 per year in adults, with a clear increase with age and the highest rates in elderly patients. In children, incidence is lower, roughly 0.4 to 1 per 100,000 per year, but GBS still represents the most common case of acute flaccid paralysis in pediatric population in high-income countries, So, while you will see it less often in children, when acute weakness appears, GBS remained a priority diagnosis. There are also age-related differences in GBS subtypes. In most European cohort, acute inflammatory demyelinizing polyneuropathy is the dominant form across all ages. However, axonal variants such as Eiman and Amson appear relatively more frequent in children and young adults in southern and eastern Europe compared with northern Europe. This is not just an academic detail, because axonal forms often have a different prognosis and recovery trajectory. If we move to GBS variant, Miller-Fisher syndromes accounts for roughly 5-10% of GBS cases in Europe and tends to be more frequent in adults than in children, while very young children may present with incomplete or atypical forms that are easy to miss. Now, chronic inflammatory neuropathies show a much sharper age gradient. Chronic inflammatory demyelinating polyneuropathy have a prevalence in adults ranging from 1 to 9 per 100,000, depending on diagnostic criteria and study design. In contrast, pediatric CIDP is rare, with prevalence estimates well below 1 per 100,000 children. When it does occur, it often presents earlier with gait disturbance, proximal weakness, or relapsing courses, features that can overlap with inherited neuropathies and delay diagnosis. Some inflammatory neuropathies are in practice almost exclusively adult disease. Multifocal motor neuropathy, for example, has a prevalence of about 0.5 per 100,000 and is especially rare in children. Anti-MAG-associated neuropathy is essentially confined to adult or older, reflecting its strong association with monoclonal gammopathies. Similarly, vasculitic neuropathies predominantly affect adults and elderly patients and are rarely encountered in pediatric neurology. On the other hand, certain immunomediated neuropathic presentations are proportionally more relevant in children. Acute post-infection neuropathies, including GBS and some painful neuritic syndrome following viral illness, are a classic pediatric scenario. Antecedent infections are identified in up to 2/3 of pediatric GBS cases, compared with lower proportion in adults, where comorbidities and systemic disease play a larger role. European epidemiology also reminds us that geography matters. Northern European cohort tends to report older age at onset for many inflammatory neuropathies, while southern and eastern region often show younger onset and a slightly higher proportion of axonal forms. These differences likely reflect a complex interaction between infections, genetics, environmental factors, and healthcare access. So, already, just by considering age and context, we are not only estimating probability, we are shaping our differential diagnosis, our diagnostic strategy, and our expectation for outcome. So, when we ask whether children are small adults, inflammatory neuropathies give us a clear answer. Not really. The same diagnostic label may hide different epidemiology, different triggers, and different clinical challenge. And with this overview in mind, I think this is the perfect moment to move from how often and in whom this disease occurs to how they are actually present and how we recognize them early, which is where Matteo's expertise will guide us next.
Thank you, Francesco. I think that the real challenge is that in pediatrics, GBS often does not look like classic GBS, especially in infants and young children. So how do children present and how is this different from adults? In school-age children, the story can still sound familiar. A perfectly well child develops leg pain, then starts limping or refusing to walk, and over a few days you begin to see symmetric weakness and reduced or absent reflexes. But pain plays a much bigger role in pediatrics than adults. Adults often report paresthesias early. Younger children may not be able to describe sensory symptoms at all, so you see behavioral equivalence, irritability, crying with movement, refusal to stand, or parents saying, "It looks like their legs hurt." Progression can be fast. Some children reach NADA within a few days. Cranial nerve involvement is not rare. And when bulbar symptoms appear, dysphagia, a weak or nasal voice, that immediately becomes a safety issue, not just a diagnostic clue. Autonomic dysfunction also matters. Heart rate instability, blood pressure swings, even arrhythmias can be substantial, especially in severe cases. Neurological examination in infants and young children. Where are the main pitfalls? This is where things really get tricky. Infants don't give you GBS on command. You can't test strength conventionally, so the exam becomes observational and developmental. The first question is always, has the child lost milestones? Less kicking, reduced anti-gravity movements, new head lag, decreased spontaneous activity. These are often the earliest signs. Feeding is another critical window. A weak suck, early fatigue during feeds, or feeds that suddenly take much longer than usual can be the first signs of bulbar involvement, often well before respiratory compromise is obvious. At the bedside, tone and reflexes are still your most reliable anchors. Hypotonia with hyporeflexia or hyperreflexia remains the core pattern, but only if the child is calm. Crying and distress can transiently increase tone and mask weakness. Pain complicates everything. Neuropathic or radicular pain can make children miserable and inconsolable. They may look encephalopathic, which easily misleads clinicians toward meningitis or encephalitis and delays the correct diagnosis. And then there's the trap of early normal tests. CSF albuminocytologic dissociation is often absent in the first week. Nerve conduction studies can also be not diagnostic early on, so an early normal lumbar puncture or EMG does not exclude GBS. When the presentation is atypical, especially with asymmetry or very abrupt progression, spinal MRI becomes essential, not to prove GBS, but to rule out conditions like acute flaccid myelitis or transverse myelitis. So which pediatric red flags help avoid misdiagnosis and identify danger early? I usually group red flags into two categories. First, red flags suggesting an alternative diagnosis. Marked asymmetry, extremely abrupt onset, a clear sensory level or early sphincter dysfunction should immediately point towards spinal cord disease rather than classic GBS. Altered mental status, persistent high fever or seizures are not compatible with GBS and should redirect your diagnostic thinking. Second, red flags for severity within GBS, bulbar dysfunction, rapidly progressive weakness, and autonomic instability mean you should escalate monitoring early and seriously consider ICU level care. In children, the margin for error is smaller. Deterioration can be fast, and respiratory failure may arrive before you feel diagnostically comfortable. So the key takeaway is simple. In pediatrics, GBS rarely follows the textbook. Developmental stage, pain, and limited cooperation often obscure early signs. The key is recognizing the bedside pattern, progressive weakness with hyperreflexia, and using MRI and repeat neurophysiology when initial tests are unrevealing.
Thank you so much, Matteo. Really, really interesting. Now, let's go on and let's keep an eye on the management. So, when we talk about management, this is where guidelines stop and bedside decision begin. Because once the diagnosis is made, the real question is not what is recommended in general, but what is the right treatment for this patient and this age right now. Inflammatory neuropathies clearly show why management must be age-adapted. The tools may look similar, but how we use them and what we aim for changes substantially across the lifespan. Let's start with acute inflammatory neuropathies, particularly Guillain-Barré syndrome. Across children, adults, and elderly patients, first-line immunotherapy remains intravenous immunoglobulin or plasma exchange, but their application differs. In children, IVIG is usually the preferred option. It is easier to administer, better tolerated, and associated with fewer complications. The key management issue in pediatrics is often early recognition and monitoring. Respiratory function, autonomic instability, pain, and early rehabilitation. Children often recover well, but only if deterioration is anticipated rather than reacted to. In adults, both IVIG and plasma exchange are valid and evidence-based. Timing is crucial, and disease severity often guides this choice. Ear preventing treatment-related complication is as important as treating the neuropathy itself. Moving to chronic inflammatory neuropathies, CIDP is where age-related tailoring becomes most evident. CIDP is predominantly an adult disease. In children, it is rare, frequently atypical, and often confused with inherited neuropathies. From a management perspective, pediatric CIDP aims for disease control while minimizing long-term toxicity. Steroids can be effective, but their impact on growth and bone health makes IVIG the preferred long-term strategy in many, many pediatric cases. In adults, CIDP often requires long-term therapy using IVIG, corticosteroid, plasma exchange, or immunosuppressants. In elderly patients, the challenge is avoiding overtreatment. Sometimes maintaining function with the lowest effective intensity is the best outcome. This is also where new targeted therapies are reshaping the field. In adults, efgartigimod, an FcRn antagonist, has shown efficacy in reducing relapse risk in CIDP and is now approved for adult patients. For pediatrics, robust trial data are still lacking and use remaining off-label or investigational. However, pediatric investigation plans are underway, and this signals a shift toward more age-inclusive neuroimmunology research. Another critical group to mention are paraneuropathies, particularly antibody-mediated diseases such as antineurofascin neuropathy. These patients, both adults or children, often respond poorly to intravenous immunoglobulin and behave differently from classic CIDP. Importantly, case reports and small pediatric series show responses to rituximab, especially in treatment-resistant children. The practical message, though, is simple. If a CIDP patient is IVIG refractory or atypical, reconsider the diagnosis early. Multifocal motor neuropathy is another condition where management is very specific. Intravenous immunoglobulin remains the only evidence-based therapy across ages. Steroids and plasma exchange are generally ineffective or harmful. Rituximab has been explored, but evidence does not currently support routine use. Optimizing IVIG remains the cornerstone. Finally, vasculitic neuropathies, rare in children, more frequent in adults, require a completely different approach. These are systemic disease until proven otherwise, often requiring corticosteroids and immunosuppressive agent in close collaboration with rheumatology. Early recognition here is critical because delayed treatment can lead to irreversible nerve damage. Across all of these conditions, multidisciplinary care is not optional. So, when managing inflammatory neuropathies, the key question is not which drug, but which strategy, for which patient, at which stage of life, and that is where truly personalized neurology begins.
Let's move on with the next chapter, prognosis and outcomes across age groups. Overall, children tend to recover better than adults from GVHD. But better doesn't not mean benign. Prognosis still depends on severity, subtype, and early complications, and children need careful follow-up just as much as adults do. How does prognosis differ between children and adults? If we look at the big picture, the difference between children and adults is quite clear. Most children with GBS regain independent walking within weeks to a few months, and the long-term neurological outcome is generally favorable. Adults, especially older adults, have a slower and often less complete recovery. They are more likely to have persistent weakness, fatigue, pain, and functional limitations at 6 to 12 months. Mortality is low in both groups with modern care, but it remains higher in adults mainly due to respiratory failure and severe autonomic complications. That said, pediatric is not a free pass. Even when children recover motor function, many continue to experience fatigue, pain, or reduced endurance that affects daily life, school participation, sports, and overall quality of life. These aspects are often underestimated if we focus only on walking. What does really drive long-term outcome? Across all age groups, the strongest prognostic factors are remarkably consistent. First, initial severity. Children who cannot walk at nadir, who develop respiratory failure, or who show early bulbar involvement have a higher risk of prolonged recovery and residual deficits. Second, autonomic dysfunction. Significant arrhythmias or marked blood pressure instability are not just acute management issues. They are markers of more severe disease and worse overall outcome. Third, electrophysiology. Findings suggesting axonal injury, patterns consistent with axonal variants, predict slower and less complete recovery compared to poorly demyelinating forms. Where age comes into play is slightly different in adults versus children. In adults, age itself is a strong independent negative prognostic factor and is built into most outcome prediction tools. In children, age is less straightforward. Very young children don't necessarily do worse biologically, but they often have more complex clinical courses. Why? Because early detection is harder, symptoms are less explicit, and respiratory or bulbar compromise can be missed until later. That delay alone can influence outcome. Follow-up is crucial. If a child fails to improve within the expected time window, or worsens after initial stabilization, you have to reconsider the diagnosis. Acute onset CIDP is rare, but it exists, and misdiagnosis at the start can masquerade as poor recovery. What might change how we think about the prognosis in the future? There are two major directions that may reshape prognosis thinking in the coming years. The first is the treatment. As was clearly illustrated in Francesco's previous talk, beyond IVIG and plasma exchange, newer therapies targeting complement activation or accelerating pathogenic IgG removal are being explored. Early trials have shown mixed results on short-term endpoints, but there are signals suggesting potential long-term functional benefit, and the pipeline is very active. The second is prediction and personalization. We're moving toward better pediatric-specific prognostic model based on large international cohorts. The goal is not just to predict walking, but to identify early who is at risk of persistent fatigue, pain, cognitive or psychosocial difficulties, and to intervene sooner. Importantly, outcome measures are also evolving. Recovery is no longer just can the child walk. It's participation in school, physical endurance, emotional well-being, and quality of life. Those domains matter enormously to families, and they should matter to us. So, the take-home message is this: pediatric GBS is usually a good recovery story, but it becomes an even better one when we identify severe phenotypes early, monitor respiratory and autonomic risk aggressively, and ensure structured rehabilitation and long-term follow-up.
Thank you so much, Matteo, for your valuable point of view and for sharing your great experience with us. So we have reached almost the end of our chat, but before we close today's episode, let me briefly highlight a few take-home messages and then say goodbye. First of all, inflammatory neuropathies remind us very clearly that age matters. children, adults, and elderly patients may share similar disease mechanisms, but they differ in frequency, presentation, treatment priorities, and outcomes. Asking, are children are small adults? It's not just a philosophical question, it is a practical one that affects how we diagnose, treat, and support our patients every day. Second, management is increasingly moving toward tailored, patient-centered strategies. From established therapies such as EVIG and plasma exchange to emerging targeted treatments, the future of inflammatory neuropathies lies in personalization. This brings me to a broader point. We are living in an era of extreme subspecialization in neurology. While this allows us to reach remarkable levels of expertise, it also makes collaboration more and more important than ever. Complex neurological disorders do not respect artificial boundaries between age group, subspecialties, or countries. Progress happens when we talk to each other, share perspectives, and engage in real brainstorming across disciplines and across borders. In this sense, the European Academy of Neurology plays a crucial role. The EAN is not only a scientific society, but a truly European community that brings together neurologists at all career stages, from all subspecialties and from all parts of Europe. Through its educational programs, scientific initiatives, working groups, and opportunities for young neurologists, the EAN actively foster dialogue, collaboration, and innovation. With that, I would like to thank you for listening and once again thank my colleague for this stimulating discussion. We hope this episode has given you new insights, practical reflection, and perhaps a few new questions to take back to your daily clinical practice. So thank you for joining us on the EIN Cast, Weekly Neurology. And until next time, let's keep the conversation going.
Thank you again, Francesco. It's been a real pleasure collaborating with you today. And thanks to everyone for listening.
This has been EAN Cast, Weekly Neurology. Thank you for listening. Be sure to follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your preferred podcatcher for weekly updates from the European Academy of Neurology. You can also listen to this and all of our previous episodes on the EAN campus to gain points and become an EAN expert in any of our 29 neurological specialties. Simply become an EAN individual member to gain access. For more information, visit ean.org/membership. That's ean.org/membership. Thanks for listening. EAN Cast Weekly Neurology is your unbiased and independent source for educational and research-related neurological content. Although all content is provided by experts in their field, it should not be considered official medical advice.